all of those issues, the governor just felt that he needed some help coordinating that sort of broad initiative that the state's got going.
Senator Jean Theriault goes to work for Governor Parnell. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 21st of August. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Alaskans have their say at a healthcare town hall.
When we went to war abroad, people weren't nearly as concerned with the huge amounts of money we were spending. But now in a healthcare reform bill that will help Americans with their health and their lives, money is now this huge issue.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Senate Minority Leader Jean Theriault is taking a top-level job with the Parnell administration. The former Senate president will be a senior policy advisor with an emphasis on energy-related issues. Theriault says Governor Parnell asked him to bring a focus to a wide spectrum of needs for the state.
It is more coordination on energy and all energy aspects in state, rural energy, urban energy, bullet line, Cook Inlet, electrical infrastructure build out, possibly tying together some rural areas where we can get some economies of scale. So it's all of those issues. The governor just felt that he needed some help coordinating that sort of broad initiative that the state's got going.
Theriault says he will help coordinate a huge volume of information about a large number of energy initiatives that need Parnell's attention. He says the governor also recognizes that not all the projects can move forward at the same time.
He's looking for, let's highlight those issues where we can move forward in conjunction with the federal government, move forward with private initiatives, and pull together, a cooperative effort. It really, I think, is a recognition of energy in the state of Alaska is going to take a much more higher profile issue for this governor, because he wants to be successful in helping Alaskans get to a predictable, sustainable source of energy.
Theriault will begin work with the governor in mid-September. He says he will work out of Fairbanks, but plans to travel throughout the state on energy issues. He was first elected to the House in 1992 and moved to the Senate in 2000. Working with recommendations from the local Republican Party, Governor Parnell will have 30 days after Theriault's formal resignation to appoint a replacement for the seat until next year's election. John Harris of Valdez and John Coghill of North Pole currently represent the two House districts included in Theriault's Senate district. It was an overflow turnout at a large Anchorage High School auditorium last night for Republican U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski's town hall on health care, one of a series planned during the congressional recess. Unlike some of the town meetings in the lower 48, the crowd was well-behaved, but that doesn't mean they were calm. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
They showed up early, and they showed up with signs and leaflets for and against health care reform. They found overflow seating set up outside the halls of Diamond High School. And inside the auditorium, a fire code admonition that there would be no standing, every seat full. Lisa Murkowski used a facilitator to pick out those who would speak and time them to 2 minutes. It worked. Advocates for the Democratic reform bill that's been passed in the House wanted to pin Murkowski down, asking if there were any of its points she could go along with. The senator countered by saying she was waiting for the Senate's version. She's a member of the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, but she doesn't like the bill Chairman Edward Kennedy has put together, and she accused him of not being serious about seeking a bipartisan solution.
Well, when you set an arbitrary date for accomplishment of something, and you do not set as your priority advancing good policy, then what you're going to get is something that moves out of committee that is not good policy. I'm not willing to support anything that's not good policy for Alaskans.
But Murkowski was not able to put much forward in the way of details of an alternative. Instead, she advocated dealing with health care problems piece by piece. Those pieces include tort reform, subsidizing medical students to go into family practice, replicating existing programs that work, some regulation on the insurance industry when it comes to pre-existing conditions, but she said her biggest priority is fixing Medicare. And there were a number of people at the meeting who were more than happy to go into detail about what's wrong with Medicare in Alaska.
Hi, my name is Dr. Ilona Farr. I'm a family practice doc here in town, and I'm here representing 16 family practice docs, which is 20% of the family practice docs in Anchorage. We went from 180 down to 75 family practice doctors because of low Medicare reimbursement rates. Our call group uniformly said that if the bill that is currently proposed or bills, we would all be out of business by 2014. This is a very serious problem as we all enjoy seeing our patients.
They were preaching to the choir on that one.
We can go ahead and we can promise you a card and say you're now covered. But if we haven't given you the care that you need, if you can't get in to see a doctor, we haven't helped you. So I've got to make sure that the incentives are put in place for our providers, that they will have reimbursement that is reasonable and meaningful. Absolutely, it has to be there.
The facilitator, Dennis McMillan, was even-handed in picking the speakers, and the two-hour meeting got through quite a few people, even though Murkowski's responses sometimes took some time. Those who are worried about the cost of the government getting into the healthcare business were abundant in the audience.
We are scared. We're scared of what this administration is doing to us. They're taking away a good republic and replacing it with a socialism, and we're scared to death. I'm imploring you to do all you can to scrap this health bill. The silent majority is speaking up with a roar. And we are not going to calm down. We won't calm down when you go back to D.C. We're mad.
Those who are pressing Congress to clamp down on insurance industry practices and pharmaceutical industry profiteering were also well represented. One high school student wanted to take on the national debt issue head on.
When we went to war abroad, people weren't nearly as concerned with the huge amounts of money we were spending at war, like with hurting people. But now in a health care reform bill that will help Americans with their health and their lives, money is now this huge issue. As a youth, who is going to have to pay off all this money, I'd rather pay off a debt where the money went to help people rather than killing them.
Murkowski plans more town meetings in Wasilla and Soldotna. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
The tour industry's push to get the state's $50 tax on each cruise ship passenger repealed dominated yesterday's South Central Alaska Tourism Summit in Anchorage. Industry officials also say they think more money should be put into promotion in an effort to minimize a continued decline in visitors next year. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
Julie Soppe, head of the Anchorage Convention and Visitors Bureau, presented the question over the state's $50 head tax on cruise ship visitors and pollution controls as a matter of several choices.
We need to find the right level for our cruise industry. What is sustainable? What can we do environmentally that makes the cruise industry sustainable? What can we do from business regulations to keep it a viable and a growing industry in the state? What is the right level of taxation? Is $50 too high? Is the $110 that you hear too high? It looks like it is because we're losing ships. Would $25 be acceptable? I don't know. We need to answer these questions as an industry.
Other panelists, like Rick Erickson of Cruise Line Agencies of Alaska, pushed for a single response to the $50 tax. Get rid of it.
I think the last couple years we've just been ho-humming it and thinking that they're going to continue to come. $50, that's no big deal. They'll pay that. Sorry. They're packing it up. And we need to figure out how we're going to stop the bleeding because it may not be done yet.
Erickson's cruise ship passenger projections showed sizable drops in 2010 from the current season, which has seen declines in visitor business across the state from record-setting 2008 numbers. With statistics showing well over half of Alaska's summer tourists coming in via cruise ships, panelists repeatedly told the more than 200 members of the Alaska Travel Industry Association to contact their legislators and urge repeal of the head tax. Even the cookies served as snacks were frosted with SOS for Save Our Ships. Stan Stevens, longtime owner of Glacier and Wildlife Cruises based in Prince William Sound, also backed repealing the head tax. But his primary advice to improve tourism was that Alaska needed to spend more money promoting the state.
It's not just the economy of the world that's causing our problem. This really didn't have to happen. Everyone wants to come to Alaska, and there's many people out there that can afford to. We just can't reach them and haven't been reaching them. The future of the travel industry depends on marketing.
Stevens recalled when, despite a dismal outside economy, he ordered and then filled a new sightseeing boat with visitors. The difference, he said, was that the state was vigorously promoting tourism. It was a position that drew support from Ron Peck of the Alaska Travel Industry Association. Peck said Alaska's annual $11 million in advertising was up against Florida's $50 to $60 million, British Columbia's $64 million, and Hawaii's more than $70 million. Another speaker observed, even cash-strapped Michigan spends more on tourism promotion than Alaska. This is Len Anderson in Anchorage.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the head of NOAA visits Alaska.
The amount of retreat of glaciers, the changes that are visible even to a casual observer are pretty dramatic.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
Protesters in the village of Marshall say they've been vindicated by the latest count of Yukon River king salmon. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game reports that more than enough kings crossed the Canadian border. Now subsistence fishermen are saying that the state mismanaged the river and placed unnecessary restrictions on them. Shane Iverson from member station KYUK in Bethel has more.
The Alaska Department of Fish and Game now estimates that over 68,000 kings passed the Eagle sonar near the Canadian border. That's over 13,000 more fish than is required to meet an international agreement with Canada, and it's more than the department was expecting. Marshall's tribal administrator says he's not surprised by the new figures.
It was good we were vindicated. You know, we knew what we were doing.
Nick Andrew Jr. took part in what is now being called the protest fishery. On June 26th, six boats of Marshall fishers drifted for kings during a closed period.
The elders told us there's a lot of fish out there. The elders told us that the majority of the fish had passed, that we wouldn't be compromising the needs of the interior's people.
Fish and Game's management strategy this season was focused on making sure enough king salmon made it through the Canadian border and into spawning grounds. They heavily restricted subsistence fishers for much of the Yukon King run. Fish and Game uses several methods to monitor the run. One of those methods is an underwater sonar near the village of Pilot Station. But for 3 weeks in June, the sonar was not working the way it was supposed to. Pat Milligan with the Canadian Department of Fisheries and Oceans.
Just unfortunate that they're having this problem right pretty much at the peak of the run.
Fish and Game blamed high water and debris caused by flooding for much of the problems. Without accurate numbers, Fish and Game made conservative estimates for what the true amount of fish might be. And they managed the river under the belief that this year's run could be near the record lows experienced last year. But as the sonar was malfunctioning, subsistence users near the mouth of the river were seeing a different run emerge. Robert Moore is an Emonic resident who has been fishing there more than 50 years. He reported his observations during a management teleconference in early June when the King Run was beginning.
It's been a while since I see kings coming in first and heavier than the chum. So in years like that, we've experience a heavy run of kings, so hopefully that'll be the case. And then the kings do look, they look like they're good, healthy kings.
Now that international treaties are fulfilled, Fish and Game says those restrictions placed on lower river users were successful. Biologist Steve Hayes says his department did the best they could to monitor the river.
But unfortunately, you know, it's a big river, We do run into problems, you know, at times with these projects.
And the effects of those restrictions have been seen upriver. In Koyukuk, Benedict James says villages near him have had a great year of fishing.
This is the best year they ever had for Chinook run. This due to the closure of the Chinook commercial down at the mouth.
But president of the Association of Village Council Presidents, Myron Nanning, said the failure of the pilot station sonar calls into question the state's efforts to ensure that subsistence needs are being dealt with fairly.
I think there is something definitely wrong with the system. Who is the state and the federal government really trying to protect?
In Marshall, Andrew says his village and other villages will try to work with Fish and Game to improve their monitoring efforts for next year. But as temperatures start to drop, he says many will be missing the calorie-rich kings this year.
We're facing a pretty hard winter.
Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
The Obama administration is working on a plan to create a national policy on oceans, coasts, and the Great Lakes. The Ocean Policy Task Force is focused on making recommendations within 90 days on how to protect, maintain, and restore marine ecosystems. Dr. Jane Lubchenco is the Undersecretary for the Department of Commerce and the Administrator of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. As a member of the task force, Dr. Lubchenco has been in Alaska for the past few days. The first public meeting was held in Anchorage this afternoon. She says she's talking to Alaskans to help develop the plan.
We're here gathering information. We're here to get input from citizens, from people who spend a lot of time in and around the water, as we think about the kinds of policies that are needed for a new national ocean policy and for tools like marine spatial planning that will help us better avoid conflicts on the water, under the water, and ensure that we have a healthy ocean.
You mentioned that you've been to Alaska in the past. How long ago was that, and are there things that are different now than the last time you were here?
I first visited Alaska, actually Anchorage, 10 years ago, and it's remarkable to me how much has changed in that time. We were flying, for example, from Barrow and Dead Horse to Anchorage, and the amount of retreat of glaciers, the amount of drying of the permafrost, the changes that are visible even to a casual observer are pretty dramatic. I've seen firsthand much of the scientific information about how climate change has affected Alaska, and that too is very sobering. So focusing just on climate change alone, there have been many, many changes underway.
And you're in Anchorage to help launch the first Ocean Policy Task Force public meeting. What's the purpose of the task force, and what are you hoping to accomplish at the meeting?
The purpose of the task force is to help advise the president on policies that would be appropriate to help ensure that we have healthy, resilient oceans and that we are using them wisely without using them up, essentially. We're seeing intense pressures on our nation's oceans from almost every single direction with existing uses and the new emerging uses. And we believe that it's time to take a step back and be thoughtful about how what combination of activities can coexist in an area while minimizing conflicts and making sure that the oceans are sustainable and healthy.
One of the goals of the Ocean Policy Task Force is restoration of our oceans. That sounds like a tall order. Is this even possible?
We've seen how many ocean ecosystems are resilient, that if we give them a chance to recover, in fact, that can happen. And one of the challenges is to have smart policies that are in place that allow us to use oceans, enjoy oceans, have good, clean jobs from oceans, but in a way that allows that both protects and restores them. And I do believe that is possible.
There's wide variations in sea ice loss and ocean warming models that are are currently being looked at. Are you confident, or how confident are you, that science has a good grasp of the implications of how warming will impact oceans, particularly the near-term implications in the next decade or two?
Most of what we've seen in the Arctic Ocean has led us to believe that warming is happening even faster than many of the models predicted. We do not fully understand everything about climate change. We do know it's happening. We do know that much of what we are seeing with climate change today is a direct result of human activities, and that there are many surprises likely in store. The melting of the ice in the Arctic Ocean is happening at a faster pace than we had predicted. And that is creating new opportunities in the Arctic Ocean, but those opportunities need to be pursued in ways that are precautionary and that take into account the need to ensure that those systems remain healthy and remain resilient through the coming changes.
Dr. Jane Lubchenco is the administrator for NOAA. A link to information about the task force is at our website, aprn.org. Scientists, industry players, federal agencies, and communities are working together to map the productive Bering Sea Pribilof Island Pribilof Canyon ecosystem. The cooperative research allows all of the different stakeholders to access and use important new information about the ecologically significant area. This is the first time the area has been mapped in its entirety. Earl Krieger is the cooperative research coordinator for the Marine Conservation Alliance Foundation, an organization representing fishing vessel owners, processors, and fishing communities. He says that understanding the canyon is important for environmental conservation and for sustainable fishing.
And so that we want to make sure that in the long term, if there are areas that are sensitive, that we know about those and we can take management measures that would protect those long term and yet provide sustainable fishing in those areas so that the communities and the industries are sustainable in the long term.
The Pribilof Canyon is one of the deepest in the Bering Sea, and its effects on nutrient flow contribute to the ecological diversity of the region.
Canyons, we know, are very important biologically, and they're basically a conduit for moving nutrients and currents between the upper slope and the deep ocean. And as that occurs, there's a lot of countercurrents that happen, and there's lots of nutrient flow, and so they're very productive areas. And they're also areas in which we know very little about.
Krieger says all of this baseline information can be used to do further studies of the ecosystems in the canyon to see how they are changing. Krieger says that once the data is compiled and verified, it will be available to other scientists and to the public. It will also be used to update NOAA nautical charts. Yesterday, Commerce Secretary Gary Locke announced $40 million in stimulus funds that will be used to survey and chart coastal seafloors. Locke says contractors will conduct surveys in coastal waters of Alabama, Alaska, California, Florida, Louisiana, Virginia, and Washington.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Two paratroopers from Fort Richardson have been killed in Afghanistan. The Army says the victims, 29-year-old Staff Sergeant Clayton P. Bowen and 23-year-old Private First Class Morris L. Walker, both infantrymen, were killed Monday when their vehicle was destroyed by a roadside bomb. Bowen was from San Antonio, Texas. He joined the Army in April 1998 and was assigned to the Anchorage base in February. Walker was from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. He joined the Army last September and was assigned to Fort Richardson in March. Last year, the Alaska legislature approved new standards for how law enforcement agencies and prosecutors deal with bootlegging or the illegal importation of alcohol into dry communities. The enforcement of those new standards has since become a priority of the Alaska Department of Law. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
In July of last year, the penalties for bootlegging in Alaska got much stiffer. However, it appears that many Alaskans are unaware of those changes. Adrian Bachman is the district attorney for the Anchorage area, and she says the importation of alcohol into a dry community is considered a serious offense.
Like DUI, these crimes are being taken more seriously, and so it's there where the Department of Law steps in, because when people violate these importation bans, we can take corrective action.
A decade ago, importation cases involving alcohol were basically enforced as time allowed for the local law enforcement agencies. However, 5 years ago, the Department of Public Safety decided to make importation cases a priority. Bachman says that resulted in a dedicated state trooper presence in western Alaska, including in the Dillingham area.
Within the last 5 or 6 years, DPS has placed a western Alaska area narcotics team, which deals with drugs and alcohol importation, out in Dillingham. There are two officers permanently assigned to that team, and that has targeted this area in a way that has increased the caseload where it couldn't have been increased in the past because simply a staffing issue. The troopers have made a commitment to this kind of enforcement, and it has paid off.
Over 100 Alaska communities have voted in favor of local option statutes prohibiting the sale, importation, and or the possession of alcohol. For instance, Iliamna is considered a damp community because they only ban the sale of alcohol, but not the possession of alcohol. However, in a community like Manicotic, it's illegal to sell, import, or possess alcohol. Other communities that ban the sale and importation of alcohol include Shaktulik, Togiak, and Twin Hills. The amount of alcohol seized in Alaska by state troopers has increased in recent years. In 2006, troopers seized over 700 gallons of alcohol, and that figure jumped up to 881 gallons in 2007. Last year, for the first time ever, over 1,000 gallons of alcohol was seized. According to the state troopers' 2008 annual drug report, a growing problem related to bootlegging is the solicitation of people in Anchorage to purchase and then ship alcohol. The report goes on to read that deposits placed into individuals' bank accounts as payment have become the norm for these transactions, making it increasingly difficult to investigate the cases. The Western Alaska Alcohol and Narcotics Team, which includes troopers based in Anchorage, Bethel, Nome, and Dillingham, seized over $422,000 worth of alcohol in 2008. That alcohol was destined for the local option communities in Western Alaska. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
Last year, the Alaska legislature approved new standards for how law enforcement agencies and prosecutors deal with bootlegging or the illegal importation of alcohol into dry communities. The enforcement of those new standards has since become a priority of the Alaska Department of Law. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
In July of last year, the penalties for bootlegging in Alaska got much stiffer. However, it appears that many Alaskans are unaware of those changes. Adrian Bachman is the district attorney for the Anchorage area, and she says the importation of alcohol into a dry community is considered a serious offense.
Like DUI, these crimes are being taken more seriously, and so it's there where the Department of Law steps in, because when people violate these importation bans, we can take corrective action.
A decade ago, importation cases involving alcohol were basically enforced as time allowed for the local law enforcement agencies. However, 5 years ago, the Department of Public Safety decided to make importation cases a priority. Bachman says that resulted in a dedicated state trooper presence in western Alaska, including in the Dillingham area.
Within the last 5 or 6 years, DPS has placed a western Alaska area narcotics team, which deals with drugs and alcohol importation out in Dillingham. There are two officers permanently assigned to that team, and that has targeted this area in a way that has increased the caseload where it couldn't have been increased in the past because simply a manpower, a staffing issue. The troopers have made a commitment to this kind of enforcement, and it has paid off.
Over 100 Alaska communities have voted in favor of local option statutes prohibiting the sale, importation, and/or the possession of alcohol. For instance, Illiamna is considered a damp community because they only ban the sale of alcohol, but not the possession of alcohol. However, in a community like Manicotic, it's illegal to sell, import, or possess alcohol. Other communities that ban the sale and importation of alcohol include Shaktulik, Togiak, and Twin Hills. The amount of alcohol seized in Alaska by state troopers has increased in recent years. In 2006, troopers seized over 700 gallons of alcohol, and that figure jumped up to 881 gallons in 2007. Last year, for the first time ever, over 1,000 gallons of alcohol was seized. According to the state troopers' 2008 annual drug report, a growing problem related to bootlegging is the solicitation of people in Anchorage to purchase and then ship alcohol. The report goes on to read that deposits placed into individuals' bank accounts as payment have become the norm for these transactions, making it increasingly difficult to investigate the cases. The Western Alaska Alcohol and Narcotics Team, which includes troopers based in Anchorage, Bethel, Nome, and Dillingham, seized over $422,000 worth of alcohol in 2008. That alcohol was destined for the local option communities in Western Alaska. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Ann Hillman in Unalaska, Mike Mason in Dillingham, Len Anderson in Anchorage, and Shane Iverson in Bethel. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Gooseberry Peter, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
And by
Alaska Communication Systems, converging voice, video, internet, and data applications for business with data transfer speeds up to Gig E. ACS, connecting Alaska companies to each other and the rest of the world.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.